We've talked about this idea that what one learns from being an athlete also helps them be successful in business a few times on this podcast. And today we have a great example of this on the show. I'm your host, Carrie Sikender, and this is The Spread. Today, I'm joined by Bill Armstrong, CEO of performance nutrition brand Never Second. Welcome to the show, Bill.
Thank you very much, Carrie. It's really nice to be here.
Bill has made time for this in a hotel room in Utah away from all internet, so I really appreciate that.
Thanks for making it work here. Thanks, Carrie.
Bill, so before you started Never Second, you ran a successful B2B company developing products for beauty brands for 18 years. I have a lot of questions about this because B2B is very different from direct to consumer. I'm curious to talk through some of the learnings that you took from that long-term experience. But first, I would like to just ask you, what was the craziest experience you can remember from running that business?
So that business we started in 2000. So it was over a long course of 18 years. But I think some of my fondest and craziest memories were going back to the early 2000s when we first started. We were one of the first companies that was really pioneering Asia-based manufacturing. And so I had the pleasure of going to China a lot. And at that time, it was a bit of Wild West. It changed a lot. It was amazing to see the change in the sophistication at the factories and the people we worked with over that 18-year span. But I would say I have a lot of stories to tell about my time in China, but it was really just an amazing experience in the very beginning, kind of going out and doing this. Really, it felt like going to another planet because you were going to a place where you didn't know if they could really manage English well enough, because I certainly couldn't manage Mandarin. I was going to say that was probably my fondest memories and some of the kind of the most creative moments, and having to figure out every day how you were going to make things work. But that obviously changed a lot over that 20-year period.
Mm-hmm. And what in particular made it creative, like figuring out how to communicate or?
Yeah, figuring out how to communicate, going there, not even knowing if a factory was capable of producing what you were hoping they could produce. There was a lot of nerve-wracking moments. I mean, you'd go there and you'd say, okay, I believe this is going to go well, but I have a client with me from the US that's a major brand and this could completely flop. But you just kind of dive in and do it. And over time, I met some really amazing people. One thing I really learned there was I needed advocates on the other side, people who could really watch my back. And I was going to say, I've met some folks in mainland China who I would consider family at this point. I mean, we've gotten to know each other really well. I've gotten to know their families, their children, and seen them grow up. So to me, that experience just was priceless. But I was going to say, there's definitely some scary moments when you were going there, not really knowing what to expect.
Yeah, absolutely. Did you have a translator? And was your client there with you?
Oftentimes, yes. A lot of times they would come. And a lot of times you were also, in the early days over there, you were hoping things would go well. Sometimes the expectations from US customers going overseas would be a certain way. And sometimes, whether it's food they've never seen before, restroom facilities that they've definitely not seen before, you'd have some pretty funny moments. But yeah, for sure, we probably brought 25 to 50 customers physically came with us to Asia over that. I went there probably six times a year for a good 15 years. So I became very familiar with mainland China.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And now that you're running Never Second, so you're running a consumer brand, performance nutrition, and you're also manufacturing products. So what did you learn from all your years running manufacturing for other brands? And how have you applied it to Never Second?
That was definitely the easy part, I think, has been the manufacturing, because we had, over the period of time with my past company, we manufactured thousands of projects. Mm-hmm. It's something that becomes so intuitive that you know that part is really easy. Everything from validation of manufacturing partners to making sure that they're following best practice, testing, regulatory, all of that sort of work comes naturally and very easily for me because we've been doing it for so long. But it definitely has been a lot of challenges. I probably coming in, I thought it was going to be a little bit easier. And it's been a little, you know, definitely been some challenges doing this. And I would say it's more on just kind of understanding the landscape. So the manufacturing has gone really well. The other challenges of the business have definitely tested us, though.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think For me, before I started Butter Studio, I was a really strong creative, a really strong designer, art director. That part's the easy part, is doing the work for clients, but everything else was new. And so it was really being thrown into the fire to figure out everything else. You had already run a company for almost 20 years, but running a startup is very different. The direct-to-consumer startup is very different than running a B2B company. So what have been the biggest challenges, the biggest learning curves that you didn't expect, maybe?
I mean, that's a great question. When I say not understanding the landscape, there were very specific things that were challenging. Like, I think understanding the language, you're coming into something thinking you know it. I came in as an athlete, a very competitive athlete in my younger years. And I know the community really well, but the business side of things took a little bit of learning. For instance, we started working with a lot of professional sports teams and kind of understanding the contract negotiations with those teams and kind of the expectations. That was definitely one of my biggest blind spots coming into this business. I think I'm a fairly quick learner. I would say year one since we've been in business was definitely more learning than success. We've been now in business 2.5 years. Since then, we've definitely started to kind of figure out how to do the business for us. I think when you come into any new business, you get a lot of stock advice. And I would say we had definitely in this case, no shortage of stock advice from people that were in the business. But I guess the biggest learning I had is that stock advice didn't necessarily apply to us. And in the end, we had to kind of learn to do it our way and to figure out what works for us. I think we've also learned kind of, we knew coming in that we wanted to have a unique voice. Mm-hmm. But you kind of meander, and at least in our case, we meandered our way towards really kind of becoming more resolute in our voice. And I think as we stand today as a company, we're definitely have much more clarity around what we're doing and what our unique voice is within this very competitive space that we're in.
Mm-hmm. That's a really good point. That resonates with me as well. At the beginning of starting my business, I was looking for advice from people who had more experience doing it. And at the end of the day, I really had to just figure out the methods that work for me. I wasn't able to take someone else's method and implement it one for one.
Yeah, I totally understand what you're saying and really can't agree more. It's something that I think we're all told and raised, even from a very young age, to always go and seek advice. It's really what you do with that advice in the end of the day. I would say what we've learned is get advice from a lot of people. And then as you kind of have this step-by-step learning, keep checking in with people as sounding boards to ensure that you're on track. But yeah, I was going to say, it sounds like we've had some similarities in kind of like, you get the advice, but what do you do with the advice? And then in the end, you have to kind of take some and leave the rest.
Yeah, definitely. And also things that you didn't expect are the elements that end up being the most challenging, like contract negotiations that you mentioned.
Yeah, correct. And I think I can say specifically with our contract negotiations, there's kind of what the expectation is. We come in and we kind of, in our early stage contract negotiations with, especially with teams, we were kind of taking a lot of their claims or statements at face value, but not understanding the business. And then we started to actually talk to other brands that were in the business and they were like, oh, that's the way it always works in that sport. So yeah, you should have probably done this differently with them and it had a higher level of expectation and so forth. I think that's when I'm talking about kind of the learning that you have to kind of build in on day-by-day learnings. And in this case, we kind of had to see for ourselves what was working and what isn't. I mean, as we stand today, we work with some amazing partners, both professional athletes as well as professional teams. But I don't think I would have known how to, in the beginning, I definitely would have made some mistakes. And a lot of them were really unavoidable. Mm-hmm. You can always look back and say, okay, how would I have done this differently or better? There's a few things we would have done better, but a lot of it, I look at it and say, gosh, I don't know if I could have actually done it much better. There's room for improvement, but not a ton. It takes years to really kind of, I think with a consumer brand to really, a few years to really kind of hit your stride, just because you have to figure out what works for you and kind of how to do business in the space or how to be a part of that community.
Mm-hmm, definitely. Yeah. Learning by doing, sometimes you can't be taught some of these things. You just have to go through it and make the mistakes. You mentioned the partnerships that you have, and you have some great partnerships. I love a lot of the content that you've put forward with various athletes, and I'd love to hear more about how you decide what partnerships to take on and what kind of content you decide to produce with some of the athletes that you work with?
Great question. Just to go back to what I was saying about early team negotiations, I think in our first year as a company, we started working with a number of World Tour cycling teams. And as time went on, I started to realize that there's a real disconnect between a lot of what these kind of professional teams say and do and what really resonates with consumers. Mm. I started hearing about a year and a half in this word privateer. And I was like, well, what's a privateer athlete? And then having been out as not been a professional athlete for some time, things have changed a lot in terms of how athletes advocate for themselves and how they kind of work with brands. And I think Instagram and, you know, certainly has had a lot to do with that. But I started thinking about, okay, as a brand, what can we get done with athletes that feels real and feels authentic? So I started reaching out to specific privateer athletes. There's a specific gravel and mountain bike racer, Keegan Swenson, who is within the US, really the dominant off-road cyclist. And globally, he's certainly one of the best athletes. Certainly at altitude, he probably is the best athlete in the world right now in cycling. And I really just wanted to kind of, instead of listening to the advice of others, to really pursue athletes that really resonated with us. I love the way Keegan communicated, which is very real and authentic. With a lot of the World Tour teams, I was kind of seeing a lot of what looked like ads. And I think that's why my perception was that they really didn't resonate with consumers. And I really loved the way Keegan talked to athletes, which was, here's the crazy stuff I'm doing today. He certainly doesn't advocate for brands that he doesn't believe in. We reached out to him and it's been a phenomenal 2-year run so far with Keegan. We really used him as kind of a test subject, which would guide how we work with athletes and teams moving forward. And he became this blueprint. As time has gone on, we've started to really seek out athletes who are sincere communicators. Certainly performance does matter. I mean, Keegan is certainly top in his sport. Sophia Villafon, who happens to be his girlfriend, is really the top off-road female in the country. Russell Finsterwalt is one of the best off-road racers as well. In triathlon, we work with some amazing professionals. In ultra running, we work with Katie Scheid, who won UTMB in 2022. We work with Jim Walmsley, who is 2023 UTMB champion. All of these great athletes have something else in common, which is that they're really good communicators and they work with us because they really believe in what we're doing. And I think that is really, for us, key. I have a very hard time not being honest about and feeling good about the honest perspective from the athletes. I wouldn't work with an athlete who really doesn't believe in what we're doing. And that makes the communication just a lot easier. We're not asking them to do things that they don't want to do or don't believe in. And we really truly enjoy working with them. I will add, our athlete roster is somewhat narrow, meaning early on, we started going quite wide with an athlete roster. And in the last year and a half, we've really pruned that down. And the reason we've done that is so that we can really focus our storytelling around these very specific athletes. When you have too many, it just honestly dilutes your effort. We have limited resources, human resources at Never Second, and just kind of working with a very limited top tier group that we really believe in and who really believes in us has been really effective as a athlete strategy.
Mm-hmm. That sounds great. And that makes a lot of sense. You said you had really honed in on your voice as a brand over the past few years. And this seems like a big part of it. This sincerity, this honesty, this way of communicating that feels real is so important because people can tell if it's not. I know your brand is very science-based. It's a very real product in that sense. And having a voice that aligns with that, even like the product formulation, makes a lot of sense. And it's also just the best way to connect with people is sincerity.
We think so. I am surprised when I see brands not following that model. It kind of surprises me, to be honest, because as consumers see right through it. I don't really know how you can do that. I came from beauty. And again, a lot of the work I did in my past business was beauty. And there's one of the things that really was difficult for me in the end was a lot of the insincerity that comes with it. It's a bit of a storytelling, and efficacy is certainly always questionable.
Okay.
I think one of the real drivers as we started Never Second was to work on something that was authentic and provided practical value, something that you could honestly stand behind.
Mm-hmm. That leads me to ask you about the name. What does the name mean?
Oh, gosh, that's a great question. It's a complicated question. It involves everything from multiple arguments with partners to legal review. And we must have come up with 100 names that were kiboshed by attorneys.
It's always the hardest part.
It's really hard because you get so emotionally charged around something and then you're fully invested in it and you're like, this is the name. And then they tell you 100 reasons why it's a bad idea. Mm-hmm. One of the original names we came up with that I was really excited about was Human Race.
Mm.
That quickly became a problem for us, but we were really invested in it. One of the things we really started
doing. Beauty brand beating you guys to the punch.
It was like a month before. And being really conservative, I think as a business person, I'm pretty conservative. I would never take undue risk. And that would have been a suicide mission. So we backed off of that name. We really started getting stuck on, though, kind of putting two words together that form a unique word. And that was kind of the process. We always wanted a name, too, that rolled, that flowed well and was memorable. And we also wanted something that was a bit obtuse, where a name where you could really apply your own meaning to it as an athlete and fill it with life. It's been really interesting to hear from athletes because they have their own assumptions about where the name must have come from. And a lot of athletes think it's about placing first or winning. There's a certain athlete that thinks that. And there are other folks that dearly just love the name because it is unique. And there are some other folks that understand that it's about kind of prioritization. We started also pairing the name with our tagline, which is science first, never second, to really kind of create another layer of meaning that supported the name. If you were to say, what does it really mean? It's kind of like, it can be filled with life by different, depending on who you are. It tied together very nicely with our tagline, which is about putting science first. One of the things I should say about this business, when I came in, we talk about honesty, performance nutrition and the world of supplements in general is probably one of the most dishonest areas of consumer products. There are claims being made every day that are just ludicrous by a lot of times it forces or creates an environment where consumers can take harmful products or products that aren't helping them. They're wasting their money or they're harming their health or worse. So when we came in, I think that was probably the real moment for us. The shock moment for me was kind of looking at how other brands are communicating. And a lot of it is just, they're not even scientists. I'm not a scientist, but at least we have really strong scientific support at Never Second. And Oscar Eichendrup, he's my partner in the brand and is widely considered to be one of the most important scientists in the field. What we say when we make a claim, we have to really support it strictly with scientific evidence. And there are all sorts of brands in the market in this space, as well as in the larger supplement arena, which are, they're not scientists. They're purely marketers. A lot of them are taking kind of like really thin studies or no studies and creating an entire brand that makes promises that aren't really based on anything that can be proven. And I'll give you an example. There are a lot of brands that are putting excessive sodium in their products, like this idea that salt is good and is salt in the right environment and the right amounts is necessary and good for an athlete, but taking copious amounts of salt all day long when you're not an athlete, a lot of these brands are just selling to everyday consumers. All they're doing is really contributing to high blood pressure. But the consumer is seeing the packaging and saying more salt is better. And unfortunately, in a world where I think a lot of people think more is better, they can easily kind of go down that path of wasting their money and doing more harm or certainly no good.
Yeah. And I think we're all familiar with these types of examples, like Gatorade is full of sugar and most of the people drinking it are just regular people who are not athletes. But where I thought the name came from was I thought about the placing, like never second trying to be first. But moreover, I was thinking of it more with regard to the actual ingredients within the product and being science-backed and having delivering a really top-tier product. And that's thinking never second in that regard.
That's a great insight. So I think that speaks to kind of the name being a bit open-ended, where you can kind of fill it with meaning. And I think that was really our intent. And it's funny, when in early on, it was probably not our first choice, but in the end, I think we're really happy with it. If nothing else from my past life, I have a lot of experience in working with consumer brands, and you do see a lot of those kind of mistakes. you see thousands of brands that come into the market that, I don't want to sound arrogant about it, but really shouldn't exist. I mean, they're just not offering any unique value, and they kind of are rushed by someone just looking to, it's kind of like putting, I guess, money and profits first, but not really thinking about building something meaningful. I think what we learned from that experience is to really take your time and get this, the really important parts of the brand right. Because once you're out in the market, it's really hard to fix a lot of those kind of critical mistakes that you've made.
Mm-hmm. And what would be an example of something you'd recommend not overlooking to another entrepreneur?
Oh gosh, a logo. A logo is so important.
Tell me what you think, because I actually think you can fix a logo. I'm a big fan of shipping something, getting something out there. A lot of companies rebrand a couple years after launching. And so I'm curious, tell me why you think you have to launch with the perfect logo.
You can do a correction, and their logos do go through kind of rebrands. And do I think it's salvageable? I mean, it's salvageable. I guess it's a matter of kind of in the scope of kind of all the things that could undo a brand. You can get by redoing a logo and doing a couple of years after. I think just if I didn't have to undertake that pain, I would avoid it at all costs. I guess that's probably the clarification I would make. It's kind of like, there's just certain things like launching products. When you launch a product that's a problematic product, that's another key area. Brands do it all the time where they launch products that are flops or imperfect. And for us, we recognize, yes, you can fix that. It's pretty painful to fix that because you have bad memories from consumers. Will they remember the logo or remember the product the way it was? You change a flavor in a product, you even tweak a flavor. Is it going to be well received? Are people going to dislike the change you made? And you'll get some low back from that. But coming back to the logo, I guess I would clarify by saying it's fixable, but there's some pain with that. And I'd like to try and avoid those kind of pain points if we can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that makes sense. And my thinking is really oftentimes there's so many limitations as a startup, whether it's funding, small team, not knowing what you're doing because you've never done it before, not knowing where to invest your time and money. And sometimes certain elements of the identity are maybe less important to invest in at the very beginning versus getting product market fit right. My advice to a lot of startups that I talk to that are very early stage and they want to do and they don't feel confident in their brand, which is important to have that confidence, I say make sure you know who you are. Make sure you know your product market fit before you invest in your identity. And it's okay to go out there with something, an MVP. Because there's more value in branding and getting a logo that's right once you really know who you are, is what I meant by that.
Yeah, and I think you're spot on there. As you're saying that, it's really resonating with me what you're saying. It's important to know who you are. I think that's, as a brand, we have had to refine who we are during the 2.5 years. Subtle, but there's definitely that sort of tweaking happens. And I think that is the critical point. A lot of brands, and when just people we've met over the years too, it's kind of like they're launching a product, but what do they stand for? What's their unique point of difference? And a lot of times it's hard to find that. I think when we started, there was a lot of criticism that were, let's say, commentary that we took from folks that we talked to, let's say friends and family. And they were like, well, there are already a lot of brands in this space. And our difference is we were starting to think about, like, in the world of like brands and how different you could be, where on the spectrum does the differentness come? So in this case, there are completely revolutionary products that come out. People say, like, how are we different when we came in? We took something that was already widely available, performance nutrition for endurance athletes. There are 100 brands globally that do this. But our difference is really kind of our system focus. They're little differences. They're relatively subtle in the scheme of things, but it's the high quality products. It's the scientific communication that is strictly science-based. It's the system that allows athletes to train and perfect their fueling and hydration as opposed to just, that's the main point of difference. I mean, to this point in the last 25 years, speaking to Oscar, he's this amazing advocate in the space. He has a long history in performance nutrition. When we initially talked, and I asked him that kind of fundamental question, is there a reason for Never Second to exist? I think he said it best. He said, look, for the last 25 years, athletes really aren't getting much better at fueling and hydrating. They're just different stuff. And he said, and the reason is the brands are just mostly not scientists. they're making a gel and saying, take this gel, it's the best gel. Take this drink, it's the best drink. And they're really just throwing gels and bars and drink mixes at athletes and saying, take this. And for us, the main point of difference is that we're a system that allows athletes to perfect their protocol, which seems subtle. It is subtle, certainly for some athletes, but it has been really a game-changing system for the people that know and use it. If you asked me this same exact question, or we had talked about this exact same subject in the beginning, it wouldn't have meant as much. But over 2.5 years of getting that feedback from athletes, you realize that roadmap was the right roadmap. Athletes really did need this, and they really appreciate this. So in terms of kind of that mission of the company, we've definitely needed some feedback from the market to kind of assure us that we were onto something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it doesn't actually sound that subtle to me. It sounds like a big deal. I'm not an endurance athlete, so maybe I don't know, but I would imagine that when it comes down to it, it's the littlest tweaks that can really push the needle that tiny bit further to make a difference in somebody's time or performance. At least that's my assumption of competing at this high of a level.
It makes a huge difference. It's kind of like what sort of value people give to it. We have like 140 store partners in the US. Some of them are absolutely driven and want to understand all about the science because they understand that they're really helping athletes. More commercially minded partners may not care as much. And so we really kind of, and same with consumers, we operate at really two levels. Folks that really care about the science and really leverage the system, and folks that just use it because they like it. For us, it's great. We were able to operate at really kind of two distinctly different levels successfully. And I guess one of the things we've really learned is don't try and make everyone listen to or follow your advice. Not everyone will. And you kind of have to let them do things their way. We have a system. We wish everyone followed the system 100%, but that's just kind of an unrealistic expectation.
Mm-hmm. And if people like the product, that's also great, I would imagine.
It is. I mean, when someone says, I use your gels and they're the best I've ever used and I love them, thank you. They don't care about the system. That's we're very happy. Yeah.
I would be happy too if I were you. Okay. I have a different question. This podcast is about sports and creativity. And as a former competitive athlete yourself, I'm curious if you find endurance sports creative and in what way?
Yes. I think that, well, the people that are endurance athletes are certainly a special breed of people. I've grew up as one. I knew from my first memory that I loved running, and that was my entire life. For me, the creative was when you're out doing this activity, it opens up your brain as much as your body to kind of, you got some of my best thinking is done on a run. You just have all this oxygen going on and you're just kind of in your zone, and it's a moment that's for yourself. So generally speaking though, and as I've gotten to really know endurance athletes, both as a business person and my athlete life, they're always really thoughtful people. I would say really thoughtful would be how I would describe most of them. They really certainly all, especially the more serious ones, have a lot of expectations of themselves. They're ridiculously driven people. I think they challenge themselves in so many areas of their lives beyond the sport. They may be training 15 to 30 hours a week. The professionals, some of them are training 30 plus hours a week. It's an enormous amount of time. And it's not like 30 hours a week at the office. It's 30 hours a week, which will absolutely put you in tired mode all the time.
Mm-hmm.
They're getting up at like 4 a.m. to get all this in, training before their work, if they happen to work a job, if you will, like a 40-hour week job. And then they're training after work. And I've just always been really impressed by their thoughtfulness and how driven they are. Coming back to the idea of creativity, I would describe most of them as practical more than creative, meaning that if something's going to make them faster, they're going to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll follow a regimen that is going to give them results before they would do something that's creative that could derail their results. So I would say, in my opinion, I find more endurance athletes to be more practical than creative, practical and thoughtful, but I hopefully answered your question there.
Yeah, you did. I'm just curious because I think creativity can come into play in any space, and it could be being creative in their training regimen or thinking of new ways to approach a problem, because sports has a lot of problem solving in it. even if it's just long distance running, or you have to figure out how to do it well. Not just running. I'm just saying it's not as complex as getting creative with, you know, how to kick a soccer ball over your head or something like that. But I think that there's opportunity to approach a problem creatively always, regardless of what the problem was.
I can agree with that for sure. I mean, we do see a lot of athletes that are, they do a lot of exploration with training. There is this nonstop endeavor, especially when you look at a lot of the professionals we deal with, where they are just trying every nuance to get better. So in that way, if that is creative, then for sure we see that. They're always exploring and searching for ways to get better. And I think we're kind of part of that puzzle. I think one of the things that we've seen about endurance athletes, myself included, runners are the worst in this area, is they have this stubbornness to suffer. They're great at suffering. I mean, back my first marathons, we did on water, no fuel at all. And things have changed a lot in 25 years. But historically, runners were always like, I'll run injured. They'll figure out a way just to keep going. And that's just in their nature. And we've seen with a lot of the athletes, working with so many of them, is they'll search every possible way to kind of improve what they're doing. And to me, that's admirable. They're searchers and seekers. And I think that that's just always very inspiring to be around the sort of people. I think that's one of the things that the biggest joys I get out of Never Second. I do a lot of events, like I'm heading off to an event tomorrow and then almost one every weekend through the end of the year. We love talking to them because we choose to spend time with the people that inspire us. And if I could choose a group of people to spend most of my time with, I would choose endurance athletes just because they're usually such a positive and inspiring bunch.
Mm-hmm. It's funny that you say that because I completely agree. I think work takes up so much of our time. And if we're not spending that time with people that we want to be around, kind of what's the point? People ask me, what type of client do you want? Or what type of industry are you going after? And I love working with the sports industry, but even beyond that, for me, it's all about the people internally and externally. If the people are great, the business could be anything, because that's what makes the time worth it.
Can't agree more. I know you and I talked about that on a prior call, and what you said stuck with me when you said that you like to work with people that you like, that where there's an enjoyment. I can't agree more. Can't agree more.
Definitely. I always like to wrap up with a couple final questions. What would you say you're still working on as a business leader?
That is a really great question. It's a hard question. What am I still working on? Delegation. I like to be in the world and be active. I tried retirement for about 30 days and it was a complete flop. And I love being around people, and oftentimes inherently you're doing things for them and they're asking things of you. And a lot of times I'll just say, well, I'm going to do that. And I've always had a hard time with delegation, just because it's kind of like there's a certain joy that comes from the work at the same time. So I guess that's probably the biggest area I'm working on, is being able to delegate better. In this particular arena, scaling. We are in scale mode right now. So our biggest challenge moving forward is going to be probably, I think we pride ourselves on being very approachable and in the world. The question is, and I'd say we're also quite rebellious. I mean, I would say I'm always trying to kind of do things in a way, like in this particular space, I'm like, I want to build a brand that, being 52 years old, I remember the original Power Bar and when they came on the scene around 1990. And one of my areas of fascination has always been these brands come in and they seem to be fully focused on a specific community. Like as a runner, I was thrilled that there was a brand for me that made these great specialized products for me. What typically happens is then they end up in gas stations or mass market or grocery stores. And that credibility and kind of that special relationship that the consumer has or an athlete has with the brand disappears overnight. One of the things we kind of came in to challenge ourselves with Never Second was, can we build a brand that stays credible? Now, we're making a very deliberate decision at that point to be in the tens or hundreds of millions of dollars in terms of revenue and not billions. Because when you're choosing to be a niche brand, you are just limited by size and scale. The market just is only so big. I guess one of our challenges, even as we go kind of from this kind of 2.5-year-old brand heading towards being a national and global leader, are we still able to maintain our local feel and to really kind of be that one-on-one brand that we're known for today? I know thousands of athletes right now who come over and say hello at races and we chat, and I'd like not to lose that. We have to kind of figure out a way to do that, to foster those, to grow the brand in such a way that we're able to still maintain that one-on-one consumer relationship, which I think people really appreciate.
Mm-hmm. You would grow the brand, but still always targeting within endurance sports, not expanding beyond it. Is that what you mean by staying at this size?
Correct. I mean, in this space, in the endurance nutrition space, this specific product line, at full scale, the brand really can't be more than $100 million in revenue. Some people would say, well, that's a lot. Yeah, it's a lot. But if you compare it with like a Clif Bar, which is in the billions, it's relatively small. Our challenge is kind of as we grow up towards that, we're kind of going in towards that 10 million up to that 100 million revenue mark. Our hope is to maintain, to really not pivot and not change. We have no desire to really head out of endurance sports. We don't want to go into strength sports. We're not going into kind of the fitness and gym world that just isn't of interest to us. We do some work with start and stop sports, your American football, basketball. We do some work in that arena, but endurance sports are really our bread and butter, and we really want to stay here. I think there's always this, and one of the things, we are self-funded as well, so we don't have any outside interest right now, but as we start to court outside investors potentially for growth, making sure that we maintain who we are and really kind of not changing who we are, it's very difficult to do. A lot of it will have to do with what investors come into the business and do they let you be you? You know, it's just everyone saying, well, how does the brand get bigger? At some point, Never Second may top out, and we have to just be willing to accept that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And finally, I would love to know, what are three other brands in the world of sports and creativity that inspire you?
Gosh, right off the top of my head, I would say Hoka. Why? I love that a brand came into the space that was so controlled by the major players and somehow succeeded. I think that's just such a great story. I've met a lot of brands at events too that I've just like, I just like them as people. There's a rack company called Kuat that I see at a lot of events. I love those guys. I met one of their salespeople that is at, she travels on the road 250 days a year. And I think I admire their energy. To me, I came in and I was just like, they're at every event. And I guess I just admire them for their hard work. They're kind of in the world of like car racks for bike racks and things. So I know they're probably not a household name, but they're quite well known in the space. I think they're doing a really great job of just kind of being persistent and being at events. I think if I can think of a third one, I think Brooks, I also have a lot of admiration for the Brooks as a company. I think they've done a good job over the years and just kind of being, sticking to their ideals. Brooks is another brand that I definitely admire.
Yeah, definitely. I definitely had Brooks spikes in high school cross country.
Absolutely.
Well, this has been great. Thanks so much, Bill. I really enjoyed this conversation, and I'll be excited to watch what comes next for Never Second.
Well, thank you so much, Carrie. I really appreciate you having me. It's been great. Super talking with you and getting to know you better. Thanks again for your time.